Welcome to the New Mexico News Podcast, headlines and stories from the land of enchantment. Brought to you by KRQE. Here's Chris McKee and Gabrielle Burkhart.
So this topic draws a lot of debate and complexities. And depending on who you're talking to about it, whether they're a business owner, a homeowner, a parent, or just a regular citizen, they may have a different take on how the issue of homelessness should be addressed. And it's now an issue the U.S. Supreme Court is taking up. So I've brought in a legal expert to help break down some of the implications of the law with me today. Let's get straight to our guest, UNM School of Law Professor Joshua Kastenberg. Thanks for joining me.
No, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me here.
A little bit of your background for our listeners. I was reading over your bio. It says you spent 20 years as a lawyer and a judge in the U.S. Air Force. So you were in the military. Yeah. And served as a prosecutor and defense counsel in more than 200 trials. It says your interests are in the field of criminal law and procedure and judicial ethics. Is that all correct?
That's correct. My time in the military in uniform for those 20 years was as a lawyer, a judge advocate. And I worked on a variety of constitutional law issues during that time with cyber defense, with the intelligence communities and the like. I never dealt with homelessness, but one of the things the military legal system has to deal with is people. And what I mean by people is not just court martials, but the rights of citizens. And often that is privacy rights of citizens when you're working in like areas that I worked in, like cyber defense, counter espionage, things like that. You're talking about the privacy rights of citizens. But another thing is who has access to property and who doesn't, things like that as well. And so while we never dealt specifically with homelessness, we dealt with the rights of people living in the United States and elsewhere. And I do teach this area of the law now.
Before we get more into the weeds, and I'm sure we will, before we get into the Supreme Court case too, I wanted to ask you just here on a local level, how would you describe our challenges here in Albuquerque and New Mexico with people living on the streets? It's something, you know, we encounter on a daily basis, depending on where you live. How would you describe it to someone who's never been here?
So we're not unique. I've, in the last, since I retired in 2016, I have family across the country and friends, and whether I was in Washington, D.C., Richmond, Virginia, San Francisco, Oakland, Seattle, Los Angeles, Chicago, all metropolitan areas I've been to have an issue of homelessness. And I can't say that it's greater or bigger in one area or another. It did seem to be much more extreme in the Bay Area than anywhere else that I saw, but that's just my anecdotal experience that I can speak to. But we do have challenges. We have challenges because the way Albuquerque is constructed is that you have, and our demographics is that we have a large percentage of small business owners who can't afford to take losses due to things like shoplifting or to have entryways blocked. I mean, these are mom and pop businesses of hardworking citizens of Albuquerque. We have large chains that have closed down in some areas of the city. And that harms communities because it makes access to things like, you know, pharmaceuticals and groceries and things like that, fresh foods, things like that, much harder for some communities than others. So there's a health implication to those closures. And then we have homeowners and home residents and renters who want to go out of their front door and not only be safe, but also feel safe. So there's a real issue in the city of Albuquerque, but it's not unique. It's an issue that impacts us, and it impacts us, I would say, in the downtown area and most of the communities that are closer into the downtown area.
And here where we both live, we have Albuquerque Police Department and the Albuquerque Community Safety, or ACS, which is the city's unarmed emergency response team that often responds to calls about homeless encampments. So APD did have some standard operating procedures on the books that have since been rescinded. But I'm looking at, there's policies from November of 2023, which state, quote, when an officer is dispatched to an unlawful encampment on private property, officers shall take immediate enforcement to remove individuals from that private property. So if it's public property, for instance, officers were required to coordinate with ACS to confirm that there were shelter beds available. And then if the encampment is blocking a sidewalk or roadway, though, they can be removed. But if it's not blocking anything like that, they'd give a 72-hour notice before any sort of removal can happen. So just to give a little bit of context to our listeners, APD tells me today, you know, unless it's a public safety or security concern with someone with an active warrant or something like that, they're not really involved in the removing of property or encampments today. That would be ACS, who usually responds, and then Solid Waste, who handles the property removal. But then for added context, in 2022, the city of Albuquerque was sued by the ACLU, who's representing some of the people that were living in homeless encampments. And they're arguing that homeless encampment sweeps were unconstitutional. And that brings us up to today, where the local case is on hold, as everyone seems to be waiting to hear what the U.S. Supreme Court has to say about a case that it has taken up from Grants Pass, Oregon. There, the city of Grants Pass was issuing $295 fines to people for sleeping outdoors. So Professor Kastenberg, high level, this U.S. Supreme Court case, Grants Pass versus Johnson, what is this case about exactly?
So this case has a number of layers to it, but fundamentally, it's about whether or not a city or a municipality can pass an ordinance or a state can pass a law that criminalizes status and or status and conduct. And that may seem really esoteric to some of our listeners, but there's a fundamental rights issue here under the Constitution. And that is every person living in the United States is protected by the Bill of Rights. And what we define as property rights under the Fifth Amendment, the way the courts have defined privacy rights under the Fourth Amendment and the like, has been, you know, over 200 plus years in the making in some regards. But there's a really significant case when I talk about status going back to 1962 called Robinson versus California, that Grants Pass is essentially asking the Supreme Court to shunt aside, either directly overturn it or significantly narrow it. And I would encourage people who are watching the court on this issue, and that's every state legislature, that's cities, to understand that if Robinson is overturned, what kinds of slippery slope ability that would enable the public to begin codifying things in regard to race, in regard to gender, in regard to sexual identity, because we are talking about status. And I can briefly talk about Robinson. And what I mean by status is that for 200 years, cities and towns would pass laws prohibiting drunkards from living in the city. But drunkards were everywhere, right? They weren't just prohibiting being drunk in public, but they were prohibited being in an area when you were known as an alcoholic, even if you were sober. And there was built on this assumption that we're all endowed with free will to make choices in life, and that there's no environmental kind of influences on free will, that whether you're, if you're poor, it's because you've chosen to be. If you're rich, it's because you've worked really hard. And that was this idea that was in society for a long time, coupled with, you know, sort of social Darwinism and eugenics and the like. But Robinson stands out because it's the first Supreme Court decision to say that line of thinking doesn't mesh well with the Constitution. So Robinson was a person living in California who was a drug addict. He was addicted to heroin and he was addicted to other drugs. His mom used heroin and other drugs while she was pregnant. And what we now know in science, you know, is that that leads to a much higher degree of birth defects, of mental health issues, of slower brain development or stopped brain development, and of course, addiction itself. Justice William O. Douglas was the one justice who was really attuned to this, and he looked at a study on a drug designed to prevent nausea in women called thalidomide, which was banned in the United States but permitted in Europe, and thalidomide caused birth defects, horrific birth defects. And he reasoned that there must be something more to this. And so he did his own scientific research, and he discerned through medical research, through the available literature, that oftentimes things that we think about as free will, we're born with. And we now know that we're born with, you know, proclivities to certain personality traits or neurological conditions, or even things like depression and the like. What Robinson, when the Supreme Court really in their voting and they learn about this and they change course, is that you cannot outlaw someone because of who they are. And Robinson was born with a much higher chance of being an addict. You can't outlaw someone for being a drug addict. You can outlaw distribution of illegal drugs. You can outlaw using illegal drugs. You can outlaw possession of them or attempted to get possession of them, but you cannot outlaw the fact that someone is an addict. And that's true with alcoholism. There's a later case out of Texas. When we get to homelessness, there's two factors at play. One is you can't outlaw somebody for being homeless. Now, people can make the argument, and they have, like the city of Los Angeles, when they passed an ordinance years ago outlawing sleeping in public. The problem was LA only had bed space for about 40% of their homeless population, and human beings have to sleep. So what Los Angeles had done was say, you don't have a constitutional right to sleep if you're homeless. The Ninth Circuit overturned that law. I mean, they look back into the status crimes. Now, what Grants Pass is going to argue is two things. One is Robinson should be narrowed, that it's not really applicable to this issue, and it is. The other thing Grants Pass may argue is that they do have enough bed spaces, although I don't think they've made a compelling case towards that, but they may be able to make that argument and test the waters. On the flip side, we've talked about the rights of homeless people. On the flip side is this. There is, although it doesn't say it anywhere in the Constitution, there is an assumed right that people living in the United States should be able to feel safe to a degree that at least is reasonable, to be able to protect their children, to be able to have gainful employment, to be able to start a small business, things like that, that large homeless populations in specific neighborhoods make really difficult to do. And then there's the health concerns as well. And these are the two conflicting issues that the Supreme Court is going to deal with in this case.
Yeah, you touched on a lot there, but I want to hone in on one portion of that, right? We understand that substance abuse, mental health issues, drug addiction, the fentanyl crisis, they all play a factor in just the sheer number of people who are living on the streets today, which, by the way, in Albuquerque is in the thousands. And even though there may be available beds at a shelter, they may not choose to go there for a myriad of reasons, right? Yeah. They may not want to get help out of their situation. How might the courts in this case balance those rights of an individual with public safety?
Well, that's a great question. You know, removing homeless encampments removes the encampment, but it doesn't really remove people, right? Because homeless people are going to go, their encampment may be destroyed, but they're going to go somewhere. Can they be forced into a shelter? Well, I mean, look, if you have enough shelters and if those shelters are safe, that's a difficult question to answer because there's a lot of ifs. And often the answer is no, there aren't enough shelters and the shelters are not particularly safe and the like. And so what's the Supreme Court going to do for the balance of it? I don't know, but the issue is to me is where does it stop? And there's a bad dynamic in the United States that there are certain communities, and they're almost always poor communities, that bear the brunt of crime and bear the brunt of homelessness. And when encampments are shut down, people tend to be corralled into those communities because they're less policed and the like. And I would hope that's something the court considers when they talk about the authority of a city the size of ours or something much bigger like the size of Los Angeles or Chicago to be able to close down encampments. I mean, because then you've got masses of people wandering around everywhere, and particularly in less police places. And one other point on that with shelters, there are a lot of reasons I think people don't go into shelters. I'm not a psychologist or a sociologist. Sometimes it is because they choose not to. There are other times because it breaks up families, and there are other times because they're simply not safe. And what I would say, and this is anecdotal, is I volunteered occasionally back east at a family shelter, but the family shelters, you had to be a mom. So there was gender specific to go to, and there could be no adult males for very good reason. And that had to do with sexual assault histories and things like that. But having said that, there were people we encouraged to go to the shelter, but it would cause them to have a family breakup for a time, and they just wouldn't do it. And so there are lots of reasons why, but it's difficult to pinpoint the major reason why. They're just, the data isn't there, and it can be what is there can be interpreted in many different ways.
Yeah, we've covered stories before too on, you know, just the conflicts, maybe the restrictions, the differences in requirements and things like that. The U.S. Supreme Court justices in this case, whatever ruling or opinion they'll issue, how might this impact local city ordinances, local police departments in states across the U.S. and about what they can and cannot do when it comes to homeless encampments?
So given the pressures that are both political and real, and what I mean by that is, you know, including election year promises, but also the real needs of the community, the safety and health of communities, I think what it'll do, however they rule, is rapidly cause cities and states to adjust their laws to be in conformity with the Supreme Court's ruling, because nationwide, we have a significant problem with homelessness. And I think across the political aisle, there's an agreement on the fact that that problem exists. So I think the one thing that we won't see is cities just say, well, there's nothing we can do and get rid of the existing ordinances and the like and not replace it. I think you'll see proactive things going on across, you know, the country. The other thing is that private property is different than public property under the law. And this Supreme Court ruling, in theory, should only touch upon public property. When you brought up what the Albuquerque Police Department's prior policies were in regard to private property, it all makes sense, because there the police are trying to do two things. One is they're not just protecting society, they're also stopping the potential for violence from both directions, from the homeless side, but also from the property owner side. And so that's fundamentally different than in the public space. It may be the case that one thing that happens is that there's a renewed push and recognition that taxpayer dollars have to go and build more homeless shelters, build more jobs programs, build more mental health facility capabilities to deal with people. You know, in the United States, I don't want to bash on the United States. It's my country and your country, but I've also been stationed and traveled in Japan and in Europe, particularly in Scandinavia, and in Germany for a long time. And there is a homeless issue there, but it's nowhere as acute as we are, because societal resources are being spent there in a manner that they're not here in the United States.
As far as what's happening in Grants Pass in this case, what we're seeing here in Albuquerque, for example, it sounds like people were getting fined money for sleeping in public places in Oregon. Do the same legal arguments hold up if we're talking about removing encampments from public property without a monetary fine or citation?
Well, one thing I'd ask if I were a justice on that is any penalty deterrent, any penalty should have within it not only, you know, the possibility of incarceration, removal from society, not only the possibility of rehabilitation, but also deterrence. And what exactly is deterring about that fine when the overwhelming majority of people who will be fined don't have any money to pay it?
Right.
To me, it's a nonsensical thing that puts people in some kind of financial bondage for a short period, you know, for the rest of their life, where it's not deterring anything. I think removing encampments where the encampments present a danger to society. And I don't just mean a danger because people are living there. I mean, they're too close to a street, so people are likely to have traffic accidents, dodging people. They're too close to a school. They're too close to small businesses because they shut small businesses, the customer base down, things like that. If you're going to remove an encampment, there has to be some alternative, because it's just removing one problem into another area of the city that is usually the least able to effectually deal with that problem. And so I would, like, that goes back to what I said. I would hope what might come out of this ruling is a better commitment to finding a safe ability or a safer alternative to what exists today.
And by that, I'm just thinking through what you just said, though. How would that work? How would a ruling have an impact like that, where, say, you know, yes, states, you need to be pouring more tax dollars into affordable housing? Or how would that work?
So the Supreme Court and the federal government can't really order the states. Congress can't order the states to build more public housing. I mean, that there's basic constitutional law principles that prohibit the federal government from intruding into the sovereignty of the states. But having said that, this goes back to Robinson. If you apply it to homelessness, if you're going to outlaw something that we all need to do, which is sleep, just in this case, sleeping in public, then you have to present an alternative to those folks who are getting, you know, penalized for sleeping in public. And the only real alternative is more bed spaces and homeless shelters and a way to get people to those homeless shelters. So I think that every legal advisor, every attorney who advises a metropolitan area is well enough versed in this part of constitutional law to understand that point. Now, how do you raise money? That's a political issue. The voters have to decide whether or not they want their elected representatives to do two things. One is to spend money on homeless shelters and the like, and training and mental health. And the other is whether or not it's even viable to raise taxes. That's not a matter for the Supreme Court to touch upon. That's a matter for the voters to decide, and people running for office and holding office to spill out the plain facts. But having said that, that's a very unpopular thing to do.
Yeah.
In both regards, because if you're talking about building homeless shelters and you go back to the idea of free will, you're going to have opponents of that and opportunists of that to say two things. One is to say, look, we've got to pay for police. We've got to pay for other first responders. They're important. We've got to pay for public schools, for kids to grow up and have a chance. We've got to pay for roads and constructions. These adults made a choice. So, I mean, there's lots of things that have to be done and discussions that have to be held before any solution on this really big problem is addressed.
Yeah. And it's a complicated one for sure. Here in New Mexico, attorney Laura Shower Ives, she's a co-counselor with the ACLU in the local lawsuit. She spoke to KRQE about the Supreme Court case and said, quote, if they do decide to criminalize people's very existence in public when they don't have anywhere else to go, we are able to make an argument in New Mexico under our state constitution that it would be cruel and unusual punishment and counterproductive, end quote. So that idea of cruel and unusual punishment, that's a term we've heard before. Can you explain the legal definition of cruel and unusual punishment? And what does our state constitution say about it?
So our state constitution mirrors the federal constitution. The Eighth Amendment of the federal constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And that's evolved over time. At the beginning of our country's history, cruel and unusual punishment meant debtors, you know, it could be like debtors' prisons were one idea. There were exceedingly long sentences for minor crimes, public displays of things like the stocks, things like that. Over time, cruel and unusual punishment, in the words of the Supreme Court itself, at the very time our state comes into being, the U.S. Supreme Court talks about evolving standards of decency that civilized societies agree upon. So it's a very flexible and growing one. As an example, there were crimes prior to the 1950s that someone would lose their United States citizenship from if they were convicted automatically, like desertion from the military. Those crimes dated back to the Civil War. Supreme Court said that's cruel and unusual punishment in a case called Trop versus Dulles. So executing children, executing individuals with an IQ of lower than 75 has been deemed as being cruel and unusual punishment in capital cases. Some things that may look like cruel and unusual punishment have been upheld, like the three strikes laws, the habitual offenders, three minor crimes resulting in long sentences has been upheld in many, you know, in many state Supreme Courts, including our own here in New Mexico. Having a sentence, and it doesn't just have to be a prison sentence, but a sentence like Grants Pass, where it doesn't deter anything and people found guilty of it don't have the ability to pay it, like the fine, that can be deemed as cruel and unusual punishment. Now, here's the thing about the Eighth Amendment. The Eighth Amendment speaks to adjudged sentences. It doesn't speak to possibilities. So what I mean by that is you could have the death penalty on the books for children, but you can never sentence a child to death. Okay, so that's kind of a, so you could have lots of laws on the books still that violate the Eighth Amendment if they're carried out. But if they're not carried out, I don't, you know, they shouldn't be on the books, but oftentimes, I mean, sometimes they are. Removing someone from their home is less of an Eighth Amendment issue, an encampment, for example, than it is a Fourth Amendment issue. And that may be a nuanced argument, but it is in that because you don't really, you have state action, but you don't have a, you don't have an arrest, you don't have an indictment, you don't have a prison sentence. Criminalizing conduct, though, can get you into Eighth Amendment territory. And I think the argument that's going to be made here on the side for those advocating for homeless rights is that it's cruel and unusual punishment to remove someone from their home. And if their home is a giant cardboard box, under other parts of law, like the law of self-defense, it's entitled to the same status as a house or a hotel room or an apartment that's being rented if it's in a public place. And I think that's the argument that they're going to be making, that it's cruel and unusual punishment because it puts them back on the street without their choice. These are really fights of conflicting rights, the rights of people to feel safe, the rights of people living in homes and apartments with, you know, their kids, with their jobs and the like, with their health, to feel safe, to be protected, and to drive your car, you know, and the like, versus the rights of people to live a lifestyle, whether they've chosen to or not. And that's the homelessness. I don't mean it's a choice of a lifestyle, but to be in that life situation, because they too have rights under the Bill of Rights. And so that's why there's this clash going on in the Supreme Court.
Yeah. And in many ways, it has become a politicized issue, you know, and depending on maybe your profession, your politics, how this issue may or may not impact you personally could change your opinion on how you think it should be handled. But there's also a more conservative makeup in the U.S. Supreme Court right now that's also been in the news a lot. How much do you see politics coming into play when it comes to how the U.S. Supreme Court will decide this case?
Every justice on the Supreme Court likes to say they rule on the basis of their interpretation of the Constitution, and politics plays nothing into it. Most of us who practice law and most of society would say that's impossible to do. You may try to do it. You may convince yourself you're doing it, but that's impossible to do. Look, the U.S. Supreme Court lives in a very rarefied environment. They often live in gated communities. Their clerks often come from places of privilege, often, but not always. They're as far removed from homelessness as anyone I can imagine would be. And from their many, most of them from their upbringing to the present. And I know some of them may say, well, look, I grew up and I, you know, my church worked with a homeless population and the like. But at the end of the day, I think there's a huge disconnect between them and this particular issue, because this particular issue is grounded in the real world of both sides of the argument about which right is going to prevail over which. But I would say conservatism doesn't always mean that the property owner or the wealthy prevail. It doesn't. And this is the caution I'd have for people who would say, well, the time is ripe for the Supreme Court to overturn Robinson. I'm not sure of that. And the reason why I'm not sure of that has to do with a prior case on eminent domain. And that occurred when a state or a city attempted to remove people from very poor and decrepit homes that they lived in, and some of them owned, for a waterfront improvement project. And there were conservative justices who made the point, and this goes back to when Scalia was still alive, that those people, no matter how poor they are, no matter how decrepit their homes are entitled to the same property rights as someone living in Beverly Hills or Westchester County, New York, or some of the other wealthy areas of the country. And I think, you know, it's hard for me to say what a true originalist or a true conservative would do, but it strikes me that conservatives, one, they don't speak with a unified voice. We know this with Justice Gorsuch often siding with or arguing with the rights of Native American sovereignty and his fellow conservatives not doing so. I don't think the conservatives on this case are likely to rule with a unified voice. It wouldn't surprise me if there's a split court, and it wouldn't surprise me if Johnson et al. Prevails over Grant's Pass as a result of that. And I don't think the conservatives could just right now convince, you know, them should convince themselves or the city of Grants Pass, which, by the way, is not that conservative of a government, could just say, well, we've got this in the bag. Because in point of fact, they don't. They have two things working against them. One is precedent, and the other, you know, going back to Robinson case and before. And the other is, at the end of the day, the Bill of Rights applying to every single person living in this country.
And we're not the only state right now that's looking at this case and waiting to see what kind of legal precedent it will set. How much of the Supreme Court decision you think will have an immediate effect on states?
I think it'll have an immediate effect because I think state legislatures in an election year are going to rush to come out with new laws to say to their people, their voting public, look, we're trying to do something about this. It's going to alter in different areas. Like I said, I've spent a lot of time in San Francisco, and for being one of the nation's most progressively liberal cities, it is capitalism run amok when you look at the housing prices and the lack of affordable housing in that area, and a huge and often very aggressive homeless population that lives there. Their city ordinances are likely to be substantially different than Atlanta's or than our own. And so I think you're not going to see anything that's uniform across the country, but I do think you're going to see this proactive attempt to change things.
Albeit maybe still messy.
Very, very messy. Yeah.
Is there anything I'm missing, Professor, that you think people should understand about this case or that I haven't asked you about?
You know, I think there's two things. One is that if the court is going to overturn Robinson versus California, or even narrow it significantly, I think there's a real danger of a slippery slope argument towards accepting restrictions based on other statuses. For example, you know, gender identification, sexual orientation. And the court has to be very cautious in how they rule if they're going to do that, because there is the possibility of undoing some significant civil rights cases that came about after Robinson in regard to discrimination. So that's one. The other thing is that the public should just understand is that this isn't about right and wrong. It's not that clear cut, because whichever side prevailed, the other side is going to have some fundamental rights that we've taken as part of who we are reduced. If you look at the decision that way, and it's true either way, if you look at it that way, I would encourage the general public to understand that this takes a community solution. You cannot just pick people up and move them. And so that's, I think, the two things that I would say that are the most important about how the court rules, however they rule in this.
Yeah, it sounds like there's no clear winner at the end, no. If you will.
No, there isn't.
Well, Professor Kastenberg, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Not at all. Thank you.
Thanks again to UNM School of Law Professor Joshua Kastenberg for joining me for this conversation. Again, it's a complex issue with a lot of complex solutions. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to issue an opinion on this, but there's no clear deadline, if you will, on when that will happen. As far as what this means, though, the Supreme Court will decide whether it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment to fine, ticket, or jail someone for sleeping outside on public property, even if they have nowhere else to go. So a ruling in favor of the plaintiffs in this issue would make it essentially easier for communities to clear out homeless encampments, even if there's no available place for them to go within those communities. So we will keep an eye on that Supreme Court case and how that could impact even local homeless issues that we have here in New Mexico. If you have a story idea or something you'd like to hear about on our podcast, feel free to reach out. I'm gabrielle.burkhardt@krqe.com and gburknm on social media. Thank you all for listening.